Welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio. It is a great pleasure to be talking to you today, and can I encourage you to have a look at our website. I recently launched a completely redesigned website, which is optimized for display on mobile devices, tablets, iPhones, Android phones, as well as your desktop computers. And I think you'll find it's a little bit easier to access. And I've attempted to facilitate a membership so people can create an account on there. And I really would like to encourage people to join the site as members and start leaving some comments. I've actually had the site kind of locked up for quite a few months because we had a number of problems with it. But now that it's actually finished and the rebuild is finished, I really want to encourage people to try and start using Truth News as a community vehicle. And any feedback you have about that process, if you're having trouble registering, do let me know. Well, I'd like to continue now with actually the interview we were playing earlier. This is the interview recorded by Leah Shanley from the March Against Monsanto. A really excellent interview here with singer-songwriter and biodynamic farmer Kelly Newton. And I'll just continue where we left off before the break.
That's why there was such a huge issue with Terry Redman allowing genetically modified seeds to come across the Nullarbor to Western Australia. Prior to that time, Western Australia was GM free. That man, by himself, not quite sure how he managed to do it, he was responsible for bringing GM seeds into Western Australia. My husband and I, we were activists to stop GM coming in for years. And overnight, GM came in. Terry Redman made this little law saying, oh, you know, we'll have a little boundary, a barrier to stop the GM seeds going to the other people who are non-GM. Well, I don't know whether Terry Redman's suddenly become God of the wind and the birds, but you cannot stop wind, you cannot stop birds, you cannot stop those GM seeds from going wherever the wind blows them. So once you have genetically modified seeds brought into an area, doesn't matter whether you have GM, non-GM labeling, oh, this is GM, this is non-GM. Over time, the seeds are coming, and all of a sudden, you won't be able to say anything's non-GM. And that's why the song that I finished writing this morning is saying, wake up people, we've got to close this gate before it's too late. We've got to close this gate. People need to wake up and start asking questions. If you're a skeptic, start asking questions. Start finding out what's really going on. I always want to know who's making the profit.
Final question, just to bring a little bit of awareness to Steve Marsh and his case. For people that perhaps aren't aware, just a quick explanation about what that's all about and how we can get on board and see what's happening and perhaps give him a hand.
Well, Steve Marsh, he's an organic farmer. As I said today in the rally, we are biodynamic farmers, the organic farmers. It's hard work, and he had his farm going beautifully, organically, 20 years. His neighbour planted GM canola, and unfortunately the Terry Redman barrier didn't work because the wind did blow and the rain did flow. And Steve Marsh, you know, he's had his land contaminated with GM seeds and he has lost his organic grading. And now he's going to court to fight for, you know, compensation, to fight against this, the thing that's happened. But the interesting thing to me is that it's two neighbours, one of whom listened to the propaganda from Monsanto and probably all the people who came to Cogen up. They came to Williams, where we live. They have a whole, you know, myriad of people who go, this is the greatest thing to ever be invented in the history of humanity. And then they just pump and pump and pump and pump this information. And then, you know, the farmers of the whole world aren't necessarily doing that well financially. They're looking for something to boost their profits. A lot of farmers have got big debt to the banks, and they're looking for something that's going to help them to continue on being farmers. So Steve Marsh's neighbour, it's understandable why he went, oh, this sounds like a good idea. Terry Redman really is responsible for that. So I'm not quite sure why two friends, neighbours, who are now at war, why the fighting's going between them. Who is responsible?
Yeah. How important do you think the case is in the overall situation with the GM Foods? I mean, I think it's a pretty, like, if he wins or loses, I think it's going to say, send quite a big message to Monsanto, do you think?
I don't know whether Monsanto even would care about it. I mean, they're a multi-billion dollar company. I just don't even know. I can't even say whether they'll even care about it. But it is a case that will draw a lot of attention to it. So, you know, the thing that I say to people, Monsanto is a very clever company. They are marketing to the farmers. If the consumers knew what is going on in the country, I grew up as a real city girl. I was a lawyer and then I was an actress and then I became a biodynamic farmer. So I've had a very interesting, you know, changes in my life and met many different kinds of people. But what shocks me is what is going on in the country, you know, like with agriculture. We now have a situation where people really believe that you have to put on superphosphate, you have to use chemicals. And now people are going, oh, we've got to get into GM because that's the future, that's the technology. And it's all like this, whoa, hype. And when we were starting to farm biodynamically, people were going, you are loco, you are crazy, your farm is going to be barren. You can, anyway, that was, they said in 10 years, gone. 25 years later, thriving, pasture up to here, beautiful, beautiful environment. Anyone who comes there is touched by the moisture, really, the life that comes from biodynamic agriculture, life in the soil. What the chemical farming industry is producing is death. Death to the soil, death to the bacteria in the soil. And the carbon farmers of America, a few years ago, released a quite brave report saying that really, if there is such a thing as global warming and things are, you know, changing in the environment, possibly the biggest cause of this is the destruction of the bacteria in the soil by conventional agriculture. And I throw that one out to anyone who wants to talk about it. Lots of the big, you know, GM technology people and all these people, they're in a hype. They're in the hype. And I say, come and see what we're doing at Baranang on our farm, because no chemicals, no artificial fertilizers for 25 years. It's a long time.
Okay, that was Kelly Newton, an incredibly passionate and intense person with so much to offer, so much to tell. She's had quite an interesting life, and I think having the first-person experience of the reality of non-mainstream approaches to farming from someone like that is just gold. It's just so important. Because, of course, the tendency is for people to conflate ideas about alternative ways of eating and growing with other kind of like hippie ideas and kind of imprecise or unscientific or irrational concepts. And to give an illustration of how far that kind of prejudice goes, I've got an article here which is actually linked to a letter from the organizers of the TED conferences, you know, the famous TED conferences. And It turns out that that this is from the top level of the TED organizing hierarchy, is that they've now told that their agents, the people who organize the talks, that they must beware of getting certain people on the podium. And the language that's used in this letter that was sent out to all their agents is so indicative of the low-level control of people's cognitive process in actually looking at information. It says here, your job before a speaker is booked is to check them out and to reject bad science, pseudoscience, and health hoaxes. Vetting your speakers is hard work and can lead to uncomfortable moments. But as TED organizers, your audience's trust is your top priority, over and above any other personal or business relationship that may have brought this speaker to your attention. It is not your audience's job to figure out if a speaker is offering legitimate science or not. It's your job. The consequence of bad science and health hoaxes are not trivial. As an example, Andrew Wakefield's attempt to link autism and vaccines was exposed as a hoax last year. But while his work was being investigated, millions of children went without vaccines and contracted deadly illnesses as a result. Now, just pause before continuing. The use of the name Andrew Wakefield in this context is bizarre because the rest of the letter does not concern issues about vaccines and autism. But the statement that is made there, that Andrew Wakefield's work was shown to be a hoax, is itself a complete hoax. His work was never shown to be a hoax. I mean, this is incredible. This is how the people who control these organizations get away with absolute murder. They just put in a very passing way, in a very casual way, a complete lie, a completely offensive statement about someone else. It doesn't have to be backed up. They just say, oh, we don't want to be like Andrew Wakefield. Oh, he's that terrible man who told all those lies. Well, you know, Andrew Wakefield's work was not shown to be a hoax. Andrew Wakefield had a problem with the General Medical Council. And the problem was due to what they said was misconduct. And it was certainly nothing to do with promoting a hoax. It was actually just due to some practices that they said were inappropriate, which in fact the people concerned, the parents, the children, had no problem with at all. But he took some blood samples from a children in a non-hospital setting. There were certain things he did that they seized upon as evidence of misconduct. But now people like these TED conferences organizers will say, oh, his work was shown to be a hoax. And they'll just refer to that. You don't want to be like Andrew Wakefield. You don't want to be doing something like promoting a hoax like Andrew Wakefield. I've done the work. I've done the study. I've done the homework. I know that when they put this stuff in their communications, it's all bogus. But of course, the average person is completely deluded and completely bowled over by it. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. It is great to be talking to you today. I will be right back after this break. Please stay with me. You're listening to Truth News Radio Australia, going beyond the spin, deception and propaganda of mainstream news. Visit truthnews.com.au and subscribe now.
Monsanto has poisoned the world deliberately from DDT dioxins right through to PCBs. Well, Lord, don't you know that they did it knowingly? Well, Lord, won't you buy me a truckload of bees? They've been disappearing throughout the countries. Once all the bees are poisoned, we'll all be history. Well, Lord, won't you buy me a truckload of bees? Well, Lord, won't you help everybody to see what Monsanto has done to humanity? They cannot be trusted with the future of our seeds. Well, Lord, they can't own nature. It was given for free.
Well, that was Kelly Newton there singing at the March Against Monsanto protest on the weekend. Now, I'd like to just continue reading to you here this letter from the organisers of the TEDx conferences. These comments in this letter really summarise the level of control, the level of interference that is going on in the communication of knowledge. It's so critical, folks. I mean, this is so crucial that the communication of science, the way of reaching the public, is being interfered with, and we can only assume that it's being done by these corporate lobbyists. Now, I was reading to you there before the comments that were being made comparing Andrew Wakefield's vaccine research to sort of pseudoscience. And they were basically saying, well, you're not allowed to promote pseudoscience such as Andrew Wakefield. And I'll just continue here from the letter. It says, presenting bad science on the TEDx stage is grounds for revoking your license. And that's a license to be an agent who organises these speakers. The letter below has three sections and is designed to spark conversation. It focuses on three areas. First, a short definition of bad science and pseudoscience. Two, common warning signs of bad science and health hoaxes. And three, topics to watch out for because in the past they have attracted bad science to TEDx events. Now, it is number three that is the most outrageous, I have to say. Let's just have a look at the first one. What is bad science and pseudoscience? There is no bright and shining line between pseudoscience and real science, and purveyors of false wisdom typically share their theories with as much sincerity and earnestness as legitimate researchers. Needless to say, this makes it all terribly hard to detect and define. But here are some basic guidelines. Marks of good science. It makes claims that can be tested and verified. It has been published in a peer-reviewed journal. It is based on theories that are discussed and argued for by many experts in the field. It is backed up by experiments that have generated enough data to convince other experts of its legitimacy. Its proponents are secure enough to accept areas of doubt and need for further investigation. It does not fly in the face of the broad existing body of scientific knowledge. The proposed speaker works for a university and/or has a PhD or other bona fide high-level scientific qualification. Wow. Okay, folks, I'm going to tear this apart. These claims of marks of good science, I'm going to tell you what is valid. The first point, is valid. It makes claims that can be tested and verified. Absolutely. That is the mark of good science, and that indeed is what science is all about. Hypothesis testing. Hypothesis testing. It's an endless cycle of hypothesis and testing. So I give that one a tick. The second, it has been published in a peer-reviewed journal. Well, I'm sorry, that has nothing to do with whether it's good science or not. I'm not saying that being published in a peer-reviewed journal is bad. And of course, it's good in that it gets the information out to more people. But that has nothing to do with whether it's good science or not. Merely being published in a peer-reviewed science journal does not demonstrate that this is good science. In fact, it says here in brackets, beware, there are some dodgy journals out there that seem credible. Yeah, like Nature magazine. I mean, you know, the major journals are dodgy. In fact, the statement there in brackets really should be the main point, is that you can't trust something merely because it's been in a peer-reviewed journal, because peer-reviewed journals are largely corrupt. So point number two there is completely wrong. We knock it out. Point number three, it is based on theories that are discussed and argued for by many experts in the field. Ooh, hang on, now that's the fallacy of the argument from authority. I mean, just because experts, so-called, have a view, doesn't mean that that view is right. That has nothing to do with science, folks. That's not science. You know, that's just like a checklist for, you know, someone who, I guess, wants to know that what they're doing has the tick of approval. Well, you better not talk about this if other people who are experts don't also talk about it. It's got nothing to do with science. It's got a lot to do with politics. It's got a lot to do with pleasing your superiors. Next point. It is backed up by experiments that have generated enough data to convince other experts of its legitimacy. No, sorry, that gets struck out as well. That's got nothing to do with science. That's, again, just appealing to authority. Again, you're hoping that people who are important, who have the label expert, will be convinced. Backed up by experiments. That has nothing to do with whether the experiments were actually legitimate science or not. Next point. Its proponents are secure enough to accept areas of doubt and the need for further investigation. Yes, I'll give that a tick. That's certainly the sign of someone who is open and genuine and transparent in their approach to their work. Next point. And this is a doozy, folks. It does not fly in the face of the broad existing body of scientific knowledge. It does not fly in the face of the broad existing body of scientific knowledge. So that means, I'm sorry, we can never have any new breakthroughs. It's impossible. It's like the time of the medieval church for 1,000 years, and that's how it's now to stay for all eternity, because you can't upset the apple cart. None of this Galileo business. Oh, no, 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 no. We couldn't have someone like Galileo talk at the TEDx conferences, could we? It flies in the face of existing scientific knowledge. And the final point, this is almost like a joke. The proposed speaker works for a university and or has a PhD, or rather bona fide high-level qualification. Well, I can tell you, folks, you know, I've got a degree from the School of Hard Knocks, and I'm also a Rhodes Scholar, spelled R-O-A-D, and I've seen enough BS in my life to give me a PhD in human stupidity. It's great talking to you today. We'll be right back after the break. Don't go away. Hi, welcome back to the show. I've been reading to you here from a letter that was written by the organisers of the TEDx conference to its agents, the people who actually organise speakers. Now, TEDx is supposed to be, you know, the premium forum for communicating science and for being progressive, for being out there, for being leading edge. But what we can see is the editorial control on what they allow in and what they don't is so rigid, it's so medieval, that it just blows the mind, really, doesn't it? I'll move to the next section here where it talks about red flag topics. You'll love this. It's got a section here called red flag topics. These are not banned topics by any means, but they are topics that tend to attract pseudoscientists. If your speaker proposes a topic like this, use extra scrutiny. An expanding, depressing list follows. And this is where we get into the question about GMs. If your speaker talks about GMO food, be very careful. Just be very careful. Anyone who speaks about GMO food, be very careful. Anyone who speaks about food as medicine, especially to treat a specific condition, autism and ADHD, be on the lookout. It says here, the sad history of hoaxes with deadly consequences in the field of autism research. Oh, it also says here, beware of anyone who talks about using food to cure autism. Back onto the autism link again here, the autism vaccine controversy which they brought up earlier. Because of the sad history of hoaxes with deadly consequences in the field of autism research, really look into the background of any autism-related talk. If you hear anything that sounds remotely like vaccines are related to autism, run away. So, interesting, they're giving a very specific instruction to the agents. Very specific, although it's very vague at the same time. If you hear anything that sounds remotely like vaccines are related to autism, run away. Bear in mind, this letter is being addressed to people who are not scientists, but they're organisers who will be getting scientists and speakers on the podium. So if someone says vaccines are related to autism, they're supposed to just run away, with no understanding of what that means, why. No? Oh, because we mentioned in an earlier paragraph that that Andrew Wakefield was shown to be a hoaxer. These people are incredible. It says here, another non-legitimate argument is, we don't know what works, so we have to try everything. Well, in fact, you know, that argument I've actually heard used recently, and it was used in relation to the malaria vaccine, although it was more like, we don't know why it works, but we're using it anyway. And I've actually seen that argument used by a lot of mainstream medical science in the treatment of many, many illnesses. Anyway, I just leave that to you for your interest. Obviously, the TEDx conferences are completely compromised and probably owned by corporate interests. Okay, well, moving right along, I'd like to change to another topic now. I'd like to speak a little bit about the new solar tax, which has been enacted in Spain, which is actually causing massive protests. And this is just one of those examples of out-of-control statist interference that they're just, again, you have to highlight it. I feel in some ways silly talking about it because, I mean, everyone knows it's ridiculous. And I wish it were a joke. I just wish it wasn't happening. But, in fact, it's real. Spain is actually taxing the sun. And I've got a little piece here from RT that talks about it, and then I'll give you some more of my insights on that.
Right, welcome back. The sun, free and available to everyone since the dawn of time, not anymore. Spain's are planning to tax it to help plug its yawning energy debt, as Sarah Firth reports.
There's an argument hotting up in Spain right now. The country's still mired in financial difficulty. The government's come up with a rather unusual proposal, calling for a tax on solar energy. With some Spanish cities enjoying an average of 3,000 hours of sun each year, the nation's been one of the leading providers of solar energy.
The trouble is they're producing so much that production capacity now exceeds demand by 60%, and it's meant the government's found itself in debt to producers to the tune of 26 billion euro. So in a bid to scale back the use of solar panels, the government's decided to tax those who use them. In other words, taxing the very behaviour they spent the last decade trying to encourage.
Critics of the proposal say this will damage Spain's progress towards meeting European renewable energy goals and could set a dangerous precedent for other struggling EU countries like Greece, who are rumoured to be contemplating a similar tax. Spain's energy regulator agrees and has called the proposed toll economically unviable and discriminatory. Those who've been most blindsided by the idea are people like Pedro, who invested his money in installing a solar panel in his home.
With the new taxes, they're making it cheaper to buy your energy from the big companies rather than use the power from your own solar panels.
The government argues that the tax is fair, as those using solar energy still require the use of the conventional energy grids, and so this tax will contribute to the cost of maintenance. But the solar lobby say the new tax will extend the time it takes for solar panels to pay for themselves from 8 to 25 years. As for the fine that could be levied if people like Pedro don't pay up, well, that's been set at a mind-boggling 30 million euro.
I already know people who are removing their solar panels.
Protesters say that's simply to scare people into...
Okay, I'll just leave it there. I mean, look, it's quite extraordinary, isn't it? 30 million euros. I mean, that's just, wow, that's unbelievable. I mean, what is going on here? They've said that the costs have to be subsidized by the people who are using solar panels, because the people who use solar panels are using the grid from time to time. Well, that's the strangest argument. But that's a typical kind of a statist argument, because in fact it's completely deceptive. I mean, the people who are using solar panels are certainly using the grid from time to time, obviously when it's raining or when it's dark, but they're using them less than people who are not using solar panels. Now, that means that they should be spending less money on it because it's a service that you're paying for. But of course, because so many people have now signed up to use solar panels, it means that the companies that are running the energy are getting less revenue, and obviously they're not happy with that. So they've turned around and they've basically told the government that you've got to extract more money out of these people. I mean, that's corporatism. That's textbook definition of corporatism, because it's got to be the energy companies themselves have detected that they've got a problem, is because potential customers are going somewhere else to get the product or service they need. And what the big corporation is saying is they're not going to allow that. And they're going to use the mechanism of government to enforce that. Now, I've got an article here from the BBC. It says here that the secretary of an association promoting the use of solar energy is referring to the government's proposal for a tax solely on those who generate their own electricity. They would pay a backup toll for the power from their solar panels, in addition to the access toll paid by everyone who consumes electricity from the conventional grid. Although the tolls vary, if you pay an access toll of 0.053 euros per kilowatt hour, you could face a backup toll of 0.068 euros per kilowatt hour. The new tax would extend the average time it would take for solar panels to pay for themselves from 8 to 25 years. Now, I'll put the notes and links to these stories on the site. There's quite a lot of information here, and there is quite a big legal battle brewing over this. Extraordinary, isn't it? You're with Truth News Radio Australia. We'll be right back. Welcome back, you're with Truth News Radio. I want to talk a little bit about the repeal of the carbon tax now. Of course, with the new government that we have in Canberra, it is a firm commitment, a central plank commitment of the new government that the carbon tax should be repealed. And I can tell you, many people around the country are going to be very, very pleased about that, and I'm one of them. Of course, it's not going to be as straightforward as you might think, even though the government now has a clear majority in Parliament, because they don't have a majority in the Senate. And it is going to be necessary to do deals with sitting members of the Senate in order to get this tax scrapped. Now, I've got another video clip I'm going to play for you of some questions and answers from the Prime Minister, Tony Abbott, and the Environment Minister, Greg Hunt. This is from ABC.
Well, after a three-year campaign blitz against the carbon tax, Tony Abbott has finally unveiled the plans for its destruction. And he has an ambitious timetable to get it done. The Prime Minister wants his repeal legislation passed by Christmas. It's a big ask, as the House of Representatives will sit for just four more weeks this year. Mr. Abbott says it's an opportunity for the newly minted opposition leader Bill Shorten to repent and wave the bill through. If Labor doesn't, the Prime Minister says it's adding to people's cost of living pressures. Chief Political Correspondent Sabra Lane report.
Carbon pricing's been fought with religious zeal on both sides.
Welcome to the Prime Minister's courtyard.
The Prime Minister says political penance awaits his new opponent, framing the looming battle in language a fellow trained Jesuit leader like Bill Shorten would understand.
We are giving the Labor Party a chance to repent of its support for the carbon tax. We're giving the Labor Party a chance to repent of its massive breach of faith with the Australian people in the last Parliament. I think that the Labor Party, being pragmatic political survivors, will ultimately embrace that opportunity.
It's unlikely to do so. The opposition says it has a mandate to retain a carbon price. The Prime Minister wants the bill passed by Christmas, and that's pretty much mission impossible. Parliament is only scheduled to sit for 4 weeks this year, and the Senate just three. Labor and the Greens have said they won't pass it and are likely to refer it to a committee for consideration.
Tony Abbott is a climate change criminal, and I hope that the Labor factional henchmen won't aid and abet him by voting to repeal this country's clean energy laws.
And electricity fees.
If the bill's held up, the government says Labor's to blame for cost of living pressures.
When this bill is passed, Australian households will be better off to the tune of $550 a year.
If rejected twice, it could become a trigger for a double dissolution election. Or the government might wait until next July and negotiate with the new Senate, including the Palmer United Party bloc. Clive Palmer's previously said the bill should be retrospective, refunding the tax to the companies that have paid it. One of Mr. Palmer's companies has an unpaid carbon liability running to millions.
So you entertain the idea of making it retrospective and refunding the carbon tax payments that companies have already made?
For reasons of technical efficacy, for reasons of making a clean break with this toxic tax, it makes abundant sense to abolish the carbon tax at the end of the current financial year. That's what we intend to do. And obviously people will be liable for their carbon tax obligations up until that time.
And now, that, of course, is a really interesting point of difference that Clive Palmer is going to have with the government. Of course, he's a billionaire. He makes a lot of money out of industries that incurred carbon tax, and of course, he's going to be lobbying very strongly for the refunds to be retrospective. But let me just focus on what I think is important about this whole scenario. Is that firstly, the fact that we've got to the point of actually having the legislation in the process of being repealed is an incredible achievement. And, you know, really don't undervalue it. Don't minimise its importance. This was a product of people power. This was a product of those rallies all around the country of ordinary people right across society, all demographics, and the opinion polls, and, of course, the throwing out of the previous government. Because people, A, are increasingly suspicious and sceptical about the claims of the hardliners in the anthropogenic climate change movement. B, people around the country, regardless of their political affiliations, were incredibly insulted and offended by Julia Gillard's deceptive little ploy that she did before the 2010 elections, where she said, there will be no carbon tax in the government that I lead, well, when in fact she knew very well there would be, and it was all part of the plan. And it had been part of the plan for her to say that to get more people to vote for her. I mean, it was just an unforgivable betrayal of the letter and the spirit of what a democracy is all about. And for that, the Labor Party has paid the ultimate price. Julia Gillard is gone from politics. And Kevin Rudd probably will soon be disappearing from Parliament as well, from the things we've been hearing lately. Of course, Kevin Rudd had been the original architect of the emissions trading scheme. And he was the man who said it was the generational challenge of our time, or something like that. But Kevin Rudd has fallen into great disfavour, it appears, with some of his colleagues. But what's important about this is that I think that there is evidence here, there are signs here, that we're seeing a change in the direction of getting back to a real workable society, to a real democracy. I'm not saying we're there yet. I'm not saying we're out of the woods. You know, I'm not saying it's break out the champagne. But I'm saying that these are like tentative signs. These are green shoots. But we're going to have to work harder, folks. We're going to have to put more effort into reversing these trends. And we're also going to have to try harder, I think, to educate those in our community who just haven't quite got there yet, who don't quite understand the issues. And I know I say this on the show many, many times, but I have to say it over and over again. Indeed, that's how the power elites work. They repeat things over and over again. So indeed, we've got to repeat things over and over again. So when you're told that we have to have carbon pricing because there's a terrible problem with pollution, and that we need to put a price on pollution, and that, you know, the big polluters have to pay a price, you need to deconstruct what's being said, and you need to politely but firmly correct who's ever talking to you in that vein by pointing out that carbon dioxide cannot by any normal definition be called a pollutant. Carbon dioxide is not a toxic chemical. Carbon dioxide is the food of living plants. Carbon dioxide is what makes greenhouses green. I think it's so ironic that, you know, we hear so much about the greenhouse effect as if it's a terrible thing, whereas the greenhouse effect is actually a great thing. Why? What's great about it? Well, by increasing carbon dioxide, which is what they do in greenhouses, deliberately, they pump carbon dioxide into the greenhouse, right? It causes the plant life in there to just grow with incredible intensity. So, in fact, there is not really a problem with carbon dioxide. Quite the contrary. I mean, carbon dioxide is one of the greatest kind of nutrients. Let's call it a nutrient, because that's really what it is. Because plants use it, plants convert it with the help of sunlight into sugars. I mean, we all learned it in school. We all learned the basic formula for photosynthesis, didn't we? Carbon dioxide plus sunlight. So we have to continually reverse the propaganda. We have to reach out to people who don't understand, and we have to explain it again and again and again. Just like the corporate propaganda machine tells you again and again and again that carbon is a bad thing, and they always use the word carbon on its own, which makes you think of some black sooty substance. And how we have to lower our carbon footprint. Now, the Liberal Party has announced that the abolition of the tax will save the average household about $550 a year, which, of course, is not a trivial amount of money, but I think it tends to miss the point here, because the problem with the carbon tax is not what it currently imposes on people. It's having it in the system and having it there for years and years to come as a way for governments to leverage more money out of the people. It's like putting a virus into the system that can at a later point be triggered, and it can for years and years be there, and of course the amount that it takes from us can increase. And many, many of the hardline green activists wanted the carbon price to be much higher than it currently is. So the real fear of many of us had was not the current burden, but it was the potential future burden and what people would do with this in successive governments. Folks, that is a show. It has been awesome talking to you this week. I will be back next week. I do look forward to speaking to you then. This is Truth News Radio Australia, signing out.